Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Politics of Care and Education in Canadian Politics. My name is Rhea.
And my name is Jamie, and we'll be your host today as we explore the issues at the intersections of Indigenous K-12 education and healthcare.
More specifically, we will explore the access of education and educational resources for Indigenous communities and children, as well as the impact to the connections of healthcare.
However, before the podcast begins, we must acknowledge and recognize the privilege we hold as settlers in Canada and commit to decolonizing our work and unsettle ourselves in this podcast. We would like to thank and acknowledge the First Nations and Family and Caring Society for their courageous legal battles over the past two decades, as well as to thank them for the stories they have shared as this podcast is created in collaboration with them.
With that being said, let's get into it. For most people within Canada, it's common knowledge that there is a healthcare and educational disparity between the reserves and other parts of Canada. Unfortunately, but not surprisingly, many are not educated on the more specific details about this critical issue. For example, the debate on First Nations education funding Mind the Gap report found a 30% funding gap between the reserve and non-reserve schools. Indigenous leaders, as well as teachers on reserves, have been tirelessly fighting this gap for years.
Because of this funding gap, schools have to cut back on resources for disabled children, teachers' salaries, and numerous other important parts of schooling. Kakistewa Principal Chief Evan Tapote says that the average funding per child attending a school on reserve is about $6,800, while the average funding for a child who attends a school off reserve, which is around 10 minutes away, is $11,000.
This funding gap disparity is often excused by the Canadian government as a result of different bodies funding these different schools. On reserves, schools are funded by the federal government. However, schools outside of reserves are provincially funded. In order to delve in and dissect this issue further, we are joined today by Veldon Coburn, a member of the Pickawagan Algonquin Nation and an Indigenous Studies professor here at the University of Ottawa.
Hello, welcome, Veldon. So once again, thank you so much for joining us. We are beyond grateful to have you today and contributing your time to us. So first of all, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How about you?
I am surviving university during the pandemic.
That's the best you can do.
just a brief synopsis for our podcast. We are currently focusing on the lack of access to education for Indigenous reserves, the overall impact that this education barrier has had on community development.
So we would love to have you briefly explain your academic research focus and any other information that you think is relevant to the discussion we're about to have.
Sure. So part of my earlier background is in economics, and I was really interested in something that economists called human capital. So of all the areas that economists study, I liked labor economics, and it's very sort of neoliberal in the terminology it uses, like human capital, but the investments that individuals make into themselves, and that is through education, but also what society invests into them. So our public institutions, government expenditures into them, creating a education system from the early years through primary, secondary, and then other choices that individuals can make in post-secondary. Although I did some work and a degree in economics, I did get into political science to try to understand the more political side of things. These days, it's mostly around Indigenous policy and politics more broadly, but I like to research these days in matters of land claims, political theory around land claims, what kind of moral and political claims one can make that could translate to law. But I still do quite a bit that focuses on socioeconomic matters and matters of social policy, including health policy with Indigenous peoples. But yeah, so education and life outcomes of Indigenous people.
So you have a lot of kind of expertise in what our podcast is about. So that's really great. As we know, you're a professor at the University of Ottawa, so I'm sure you're well aware of the positive impact that education has had on our society, specifically Canadian society. How would you describe the current educational system on Indigenous reserves today?
Well, so there's a division of powers in the Constitution Act of 1867, and for the most part on reserves, because it's federal territory, it's a matter of federal responsibility. But the federal government isn't the best at delivering or at least instituting education systems. Everywhere else, it is a matter of the provincial domain, really. So they have centuries, well, not centuries, but more than a century of establishing education systems that they deliver to their own citizens. But the difference is, although the federal government is capable of doing it, it just doesn't quite invest nearly enough that would make it equitable at all. So the expenditures that they've made, even historically, but also contemporaneously, falls very short of what would provide equitable opportunities. So not everyone really wants to go to university. Even if you could go to, some people choose not to. So as a matter of choice for higher education, all the barriers to get to this particular point seem to be foreclosed in most cases. So of one of the many key socioeconomic indicators for Indigenous peoples, one of them being education, you can have health outcomes and other like community well-being markers. Education, personal education, and the average education of Indigenous communities is considerably lower. And it's not an accident whatsoever. It's a very much contrived outcome of centuries of colonialism. But even when there's formal education systems that have been created and instituted, the federal government is always underfunded Indigenous children. So almost from cradle to the grave, life on reserves are very much different, and just as many aspects of Indigenous life, education continues to be discriminatorily funded to the detriment of Indigenous peoples.
So along the same vein of governmentality, do you think that treaty making between Indigenous peoples and nations and the Canadian government within the current legalities constructed through the Indian Act can improve the educational and healthcare issues that are experienced in communities?
Well, one of the matters at the heart of these issues is self-determination and being given the policy implements for self-government. So you could take the aspirational idea of saying, we would like to be able to determine the ends of our lives, what's good for us, and if we feel like we should be able to have a system where we provide or at least strive for education that is comparable to others to operate in contemporary society, then it should be up to them. But as things are, it's administered from a bureaucratic apparatus that's an extension of the settler state, which very deliberately and willfully and knowingly deprives Indigenous peoples of their self-determination. So it's imposed on them. There are in Canada two education self-government agreements, which entail, I think, just over 30 Indigenous nations. So I believe one is with the Mi'kmaq and the other one is the Anishinaabeg Education Self-Government Agreement, which came into force in, I believe, 2018. So it provides for them the means to establish their own boards. The nature of it being sort of a public good, although not necessarily in the true sense of the economic word of public good, of not being able to exclude anyone, but something that is influenced publicly, is systems very much attempt to harmonize with one another in a particular jurisdiction. So you may see differences in outcomes in different jurisdictions, like from province to province. However, there is the desire often to say, well, in our literacy and our numeracy, well, Quebec isn't really going to make their education system so that their students are so much further behind than, say, a student from Saskatchewan, for example, is that they they strive for the same sort of high outcomes, although recognizing abilities or what have you. So it wouldn't be this sort of sense that Indigenous peoples would say, you know what, let's create an education system where you don't actually have to do anything in school. So they may be harmonized to the outside world, so they're stuck within the milieu. I think, yeah, you know, and those, it's not something that I think because of the system that they're operating within is that they would want to deprive anyone of educational opportunities. So in the sense that, you know, they're not going to take an institution that's been handed to them and drive it into the ditch as a matter of self-government. Yeah. And just outright rejects what's going on in the outside world. We're going to go it alone, independence. We're going to seal ourselves off in a hermetically sealed box. Unfortunately, you have the rest of the world to deal with. And but giving them control over it, that's something that's new. There's a lot of critics of it as well.
Do you mind? Because one of our questions might be better here, I think.
Sure.
So, on top of the financial access issues of education and healthcare, what do you think about the access issues of culturally inappropriate content or teaching methods within Indigenous communities, as you said, as they attempt to harmonize with these outside systems?
So I would think that when they adopt the education, and oftentimes too, this goes to the harmonization part, is that And the critiques of self-government comes up to, or at least amounts in the mind of many as self-administration, is that they're already given something which they're expected to carry out that they didn't design themselves. And then you might find in it something that's culturally inappropriate or like is inadequate or insufficient for the lives of Indigenous people. So giving them the ability to deliver their education is one thing, but being able to adapt it towards their needs, because, well, the history textbooks that they want to teach from, they leave a lot to be desired, for example. So high school civics is barely even moving the needle these days. There's a lot of attempts by those that have, I think, that are very well-intentioned, but still teaching it from, say, the settler-centric perspective. And if they were to adopt what's out in the marketplace, because it's very expensive to get custom-made textbooks or what have you, and to, I guess, create your own curriculum from scratch, there's a lot of work to be done to catch up if they're going to adapt the curriculum. So if they want their requisites, and typically, I think it's like grade 10 or 11 in Ontario, for example, of their taking high school history class, is if, you know, they have the option, because in Quebec, they'll teach Quebec history, and Ontario will teach sort of like the rest of Canada history. If for that requisite, they want to teach, say, the history for the Algonquin, there's not really a resource that exists out there where they could acquire it, you know, very easily if they were to produce it themselves, which seems a little bit out of reach, would be very costly, and dollars are scarce. So there's a lot of those issues still. So a lot of it might still amount to the matter of self-administering. So they might just see what's out there and say, well, unfortunately, we got to teach from the same textbook that they're being taught in the neighboring settler school board, and will mirror what they're doing until they get to the point where they might be able to fully adapt it to their own needs too. Yeah. So they still might run up against things as well that replicates the problems from before.
Mm-hmm. I find it really interesting that, because I was in high school about like 2 years ago, so I find it interesting that when I was in like grade 10 history, for example, the textbooks were older than me. And that's kind of, so I was like, oh, wow, we're reading from a fossil. So that's a big thing I like about university in general, because the course updates really frequently, especially with all the Indigenous studies courses. The textbook changes frequently, which is expensive, but it's necessary because you want to stay relevant with the information. And I just find that a lot of the information given in high school is just the basics of what the residential school system was, and that's it. So it gives the implication that the cultural genocide, which they won't even label it as, but that it's over, when in fact it's still happening today. And that's honestly the biggest reason why I chose my major, because I'm doing a major in Indigenous Studies, because of how hidden this information is and how it should be taught in schools, because it's our history, right? It should be Canadian history, because it's what it is. But yeah, so just kind of on the track of residential school system, what do you think the impacts of the residential school system had on the current educational situation on reserves?
Well, so you had a school system that wasn't there for education purposes. They were basically working camps. So some of the records that come out in the accounts that were documented during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission points out that, well, although they were taking children away from their families, and some of the quotations that I've drawn from, say, Duncan Campbell Scott and earlier proponents, say, Sir Johnny MacDonald, for example, saying, you know what, we got to take these kids away from their home and community because, one, we're going to teach them how to be English, but you're still going to have just native-speaking people that can pick up our skills. So they want to turn everyone into non-Indigenous, or at least, you know, wipe out any sort of semblance or trace of their Indigenous cultures. Not the least it being a project to dismantle Indigenous nations and governments themselves. But you implement this for centuries, and also you have considerable deprivation of material sustenance and resources. They're set apart from society in a milieu where it's deliberately underfunded and under-resourced. Times they can barely survive themselves. So acquiring colonial social graces and the credentials may have been a distant second to surviving. And when they can, that's good, but they're sent off to what are otherwise industrial schools, where they might get a little bit of instruction, but the rest of the day, because these are really deeply underfunded and they're run by churches for the most part in the federally sanctioned and operated residential schools, is that the churches were getting transfer payments or contribution agreements from the government on almost a funding formula where the amount that was provided was so little that the church couldn't pay for, say, groundskeeping and other upkeep. So they worked the kids. So it was a labor camp of sorts. So maybe an hour of instruction in the morning and the rest is chopping wood, working outside, working in the laundry rooms, doing all the work that would go to paid labor for caretaking when they should be in the classroom, if this was truly the goal. But again, they're not getting the education that was provided to everyone else. They're going to an institution that's not at all like home, where it's conducive to saying, I've learned in a safe space, I've gone home at night, I've laid down my head in a nice comfortable place, woken up next morning ready to learn again, to acquire all the great education that when they return and when they're able, they'd left. So generations after this, we're still dealing with a considerable gap in educational outcomes. So there's the investment side, the expenditures, but what these schools do is, and one of the, in economics and human capital studies, is one of the best predictors of the education that you get is what your parents had attained. So now we have those who have very little education, and that's almost culturally inscribed. It also stigmatizes Western settler schools as places not safe for Indigenous peoples. They're also not safe for a lot of other racialized and other minorities as well. And still the case too in the academy and post-secondary education. So the few Indigenous people that make it here, it is feeling like fish out of water a little bit. This is not a space that is made for them. It's very much a white space. They are the exception and not the rule. And you can still see it too. The weight that's on the shoulders of some Indigenous students that come here, that they're one of the only ones that made it out of their community. So in my reserve, and we're very close to Ottawa, we're only an hour and a half west. There's three of us now with a PhD. My cousin, Dr. Jennifer Maness, who is at Ryerson University, she just defended last fall. And before me, my other cousin, Dr. Lynn Gale. And we had somebody else who went off and did a medical degree, which was really amazing. And so to get to this point, to go through university, or at least to get past the barriers, because Head Start as your young age is primary school, secondary, getting through those, and then having made it that far, being able to get into post-secondary education, it really thins out the herd. The crowd gets much smaller, and you can see the odd Indigenous student floating around campus, and you know that they're moving through a foreign space to them, especially if they've come from a reserve that might be in, say, Northwestern Ontario or Northern Quebec, because they're not used to the urban setting whatsoever. Like, they lived on the reserve. I didn't live on the reserve. I might've lived like 10 minutes away from the reserve in a town, but us, our proximity to urban centers made things a little bit more. And I've made this point before, is I'm fairly assimilated Indigenous guy. For them, the chasm and abyss between their life and what they're being thrown into, even if they did have schooling on their reserve, is worlds apart. It's a universe apart too. So it's still the case though that the legacy of residential schools, what it did, because our grandparents and our parents, they were expected to, well, leave school and just work at a very young age, that higher education was not even on the horizon.
It's interesting how you mentioned that the history textbooks are outdated in your previous point, because I was in grade 10 history 2 years ago. So I obviously learned about the fact that the Indigenous people were workers at these camps, but it was advertised as being part of the curriculum, because you're teaching women how to be housewives, and you're teaching Indigenous boys and men how to be good working men in the workplace, when in fact it's just cheap child labor.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually interesting, and I've discovered this the further that I've gotten along in this academic career, and the more I delve into Canada's history of Indigenous people and decolonial theories, is I didn't realize it how privileged I was to have the history teacher I did. Because at my high school, she runs an Indigenous exchange program where Indigenous students from my high school will go live on a reserve for about a month, and the reserve kids will come to the high school and live with their families.
Okay.
But she actually centered almost the entirety of our required Canadian history course around Indigenous stories. And I didn't realize how amazing this was until I entered the realm of academics, and I'm listening to information, and everybody's I had no idea. And I'm what do you mean? This is common knowledge. Are you telling me in grade 3 you did not have a group of Indigenous people come and speak to you about the horrors of residential schools, and then you talked about decolonization and sovereignty?
Yeah, it's amazing. So I look back, and I did some French immersion, and I grew up in the Ottawa Valley. And so grade 7, we did history, and it was taught in French. And they drew on the textbooks from the Quebec School Board. So, it's produced there. If it's a large enough market, what have you, they can, have accessible resources. And reading that, even in grade 7, and then again in grade 10 when I took history once more, but it was in English, neither of them did Indigenous people figure prominently. But in the Grade 7 French, it was centered around sort of Quebec grievances of New France being conquered, and Les Amérindiens, they appeared around the 1600s, and then we disappeared. And then it was really like New France, and they've set up like their seigneurial system. And then there was like, you know, being conquered by the English, then being part of a British colony, but still being French and maintaining their distinct cultures and society and holding on to their legal traditions and their legal institutions. They have a different legal system, and it's, you know, the Quiet Revolution and still holding on to it. But where did Indigenous people go? And we were the token mention back in the early 17th century, but never to be heard of again. Like, we didn't even figure into that history. And it was the same thing in the grade 10 English history class that I took. And not at all even a peep. And we did mostly 20th century Canadian history. So all of the grand events, and but nothing at all about Indigenous people. So I'm sitting in the classroom, and we're like 15 or 20 kilometers from my own reserve, and it is though we are people who had disappeared, just erased from history. So there are those who are very much alive to the issue of our erasure from history. And they make that added effort. So in Ontario, and I think in other jurisdictions, the teacher has enough leeway in the adaptation of how they're going to teach the class. Some really just look through a catalog and say, well, there's a textbook and I'll just teach from it this year. It's available. The school board has it. I don't have to put in a request to purchase 30 new textbooks, which are sometimes like $300 or $400 at that point. The school board will turn it down because they don't have money to spend like that. We have to use it. As you said, Rhea, a textbook that's older than you. and so not just materially outdated itself as a physical resource, but the content in it. And I think we talked about this in class, is like, you know, who constructs history? It's a project of nation building is to construct, say, you, Rhea, and Jamie, into particular modes of existence. So it has in mind a particular form of citizenship that, one, same thing for Indigenous peoples, that they will not know about their past. That's okay, because in the grand scheme of colonial projects here, it's not going to be necessary in the future. You should be adapted to the dominant mode of society and be good workers. And when you're needed, participate in the politics, vote for the party that's on the menu, pick one of them. And that's the extent of your civic engagement. Just become a producer for a Western neoliberal existence. Work. And in the case that Rhea, you were saying that prepare the women as it used to be, prepare them to stay at home, to tend the homestead, take care of the future workers. And then, but when organized capital starts saying is we need more labor, let's tell women that they'll become free if they join the workplace. And also we're going to privatize childcare so that it'll be the job of a worker instead of the parents to raise the child. So we're going to parse out parts of the role of social reproduction. Is everything that had been up to history is that parents cultivated their children, is no, we're going to leave that to the marketplace now, because we're going to get them into the school, and that's about making you into workers, not good people. So all the nice to haves, they kind of brush aside and say, well, we'll make you literate, numerate, and then good workers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's interesting considering the history of Indigenous women's power in Indigenous communities across Canada, because before the periods of colonialism, Indigenous women held places of respect and power, and they were often leaders and healers within their community. And then they're within the residential school system, especially, they were like, you are a housewife, you do this one menial task. And I think another way that this impacts is the distrust of the medical community that was built for Indigenous people during residential schools because of the experiments and the medical mistreatment So do you think that the access issues to both medicine from like an educational standpoint as well as a medical needs standpoint is impacted by residential schools?
Well, I think there's matters of trust. It's complex. So there's a complex psychology behind choices that individuals make as rational decision makers, but the irrationality that is explained by other things, the psychology behind it. So my work in economics, because that is about decision and preferences, how do people order their own particular preferences? They're very much context specifics, and they're produced almost as immediately as the choice is put to someone. So what may have shaped others in the past may not shape myself right now. So some of the research that I had done was looking into the disposition of individuals, indigenous peoples, towards immunization. Because at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there were discussions that the residential school system had made indigenous peoples very much adverse to getting vaccinated. And I wasn't so sure of that because I was in the federal government at the time, and they had done a large survey back in the last pandemic, which didn't pan out the same way. It was the swine flu back in 2009-2010. And just to get a sense of how Indigenous peoples, their knowledge, attitudes, perceptions, and behaviors around immunization, and they're not wildly different. It may be the case that individuals who went to residential schools and who were subject to medical experiments, that they individually would still have lingering distrust towards Western medicines. But the behavior itself that would stigmatize such a response just doesn't seem to be there. So for example, if they were experimenting them with a number of injectables, for example, like on a daily basis, that behavior may change, or at least that line of stimulus may change future behavior and disposition towards being like seeing any needles whatsoever. But the truth is, we are very much accepting of immunizations, vaccinations, and not too different. So there was a similar study done on Black people in the United States because they have an aversion, in some cases, or mistrust of white institutions. And what they found was the difference in the gap in the vaccination rates. And usually it's maybe, it could be up 5 to 10 percentage points, is chalked up to access. So there is the differential distribution of access to medical resources that affects both, these minority populations under study here, but it's particularly the case in Canada. So something that might have happened 70 years ago may not have something that, generations before me, like a great grandparent or what have you, may not have any bearing on my choice or disposition towards things. I mean, I still go into doctor's offices when I get sick, irrespective of what may have happened to any previous generations. And even still, they also may go in and seek medical care, even if they had been subjected to, you know, really unethical and poor medical treatment. So all of this is to say that I think in some of the evidence or like data points to the matter that it is just the current state of distribution of availability of medical resources. So communities that are outside of urban centers or far away are very much under-resourced in all social services, not just say education as we've talked about today, but also the provision of health care, primary care, and also public health care education as well. So,
mm-hmm. No, I found it interesting that you brought up the the example of Black people in America and just their distrust towards the medical community. I know that a lot of people of color find it incredibly difficult to trust a system made for white people, especially when a lot of this research is completely outdated. And in terms of Indigenous people, it's hard for them to trust a system that has periodically screwed them over, basically. Especially like the government has, like every minority group has been, like has a distrusting relationship with the government, Indigenous people specifically. So when it comes to things like immunization, it's completely understandable if there was some hesitation.
Right.
But like you said, it's just a lot of misinformation spreading.
Right. Yeah. So there'd be individual decision making, but there's also a political decision as well. So there's a lot of anti-statist viewpoints. So against the state, particularly the colonial state, although they're not against the production or constitution of their own states themselves, when properly done, you know, through their own democratic will, that's much different than having like an imposed state on us. And the same thing with individuals from different minority communities that are disenfranchised or marginalized within the political system, because they know that the system isn't built for them. They're an afterthought, and they're also, as we've looked at in our course, it's a problem to be dealt with. Like Indigenous peoples were literally called the Indian problem. It was something at the top of mind, the forefront of their public consciousness of like, these people are a problem for us to solve. They're a problem in their existence just here. So you realize very quickly that you're being shoehorned into something because somebody needs a quick fix. You're a burden for them, and they need to put on the bandage for any sort of social, economic, cultural, political problem. And they're not willing to overexert themselves or give you the proper concern and consideration.
Mm-hmm. Which is very unfortunate and a tough situation to raise children in, like under that mindset, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah. Well, it was good talking. Thanks so much for having me, and I look forward to hearing.
Thank you, Veldon, for taking the time to meet with us and for providing in-depth answers regarding this important issue. We understand that this is only scratching the surface of this issue, and that further, more in-depth research is required to make long-lasting societal change.
An important resource that we feel is appropriate to share, given the topic of this particular podcast, is the research done by the First Nations Family Caring Society. They have numerous publications and reports, much more than a group of undergraduate students can pull together.
In solidarity, Rhea
and Jamie.